What are these two realms? What are these two realms? The one is the arena where there is food and reproduction and play and journeying. The environment. The world. Nature. The other realm, the mountain gorilla wouldn't use the term, but we use the term, is the mind, the inner world, on its most primordial level, still there. Let's go to the teacher of Ruth Benedict and Gladys Reichard, Margaret Mead. Let's go to Franz Boas. One of his really great works, one of the great books of the 20th century, is called The Mind of Primitive Man. The Mind of Primitive Man, first published in 1911, about the time that the Encyclopedia Britannica was coming out in its fabulous 11th edition. He writes here, he's writing of the English anthropologists, the generation just before Fraser, and the great anthropologist there was named Tyler. And we have Tyler's books here, and also the English anthropologist Spencer. And we have all of Spencer's works here too. Tyler and Spencer. Here's how Boas writes. And I think I'll come back to a couple of paragraphs before so that we can work in also Boas working in Nietzsche a little bit. You can see how once you get down to basics, one recognizes in the handful of material, pay dirt. You keep seeing the same things again and again. And if you know the process to pan it, you can get the gold out. But like any sourdough will tell you, you have to have a feel for it. And when you get a feel for it, then you can get the gold out. Here's Boas writing in his great book, The Mind of Primitive Man, 1911. Just before this generation of students started to really take hold and come in and develop. The belief in the higher hereditary powers of the white race has gained a new life with the modern doctrine of the prerogatives of the master mind, which have found their boldest expression in Nietzsche's writings. All such views are generalizations which either do not sufficiently take into account the social conditions of races and thus confound cause and effect, or were dictated by scientific or humanitarian bias, by the desire to justify the institution of slavery, or to give the greatest freedom to the most highly gifted. And you can see here how strong Boas was against racial prejudices. Very, very strong. Tyler and Spencer, who gave an ingenious analysis of the mental life of primitive man, do not assume that these are racial characteristics, although the evolutionary standpoint of Spencer's work often seems to convey this impression. Quite distinct from these is, and this is an anthropologist named Waits, Waits's point of view. He says, according to the current opinion, the stage of culture of a people or an individual, the stage of a people or an individual, is largely or exclusively a product of his faculty. We maintain, Boas says, we maintain that the reverse is at least just as true. The faculty of man does not designate anything but how much and what he is able to achieve in the immediate future, and depends upon the stages of culture through which he has passed and the one he has reached. The views of these investigators show that in the domain of psychology, a confusion prevails, still greater than in anatomy, as to the characteristics of primitive races, and that no clear distinction is drawn between the racial and the social problem. In other words, the evidence is based partly on the supposed mental characteristics of races, no matter what their stage of culture, partly on those of tribes and peoples on different levels of civilization, no matter whether they belong to the same race or to distinct races. Still, these two problems are entirely distinct. The former is a problem of heredity, the latter a problem of environment. Thus, we recognize that there are two possible explanations of the different manifestations of the mind of man. It may be that the minds of different races show differences of organizations. That is to say, the laws of mental activity may not be the same for all minds. But it may also be that the organization of mind is practically identical among all races of man, that mental activity follows the same laws everywhere, but that its manifestations depend upon the character of individual experience that is subjected to the actions of these laws. It is quite evident that the activities of the human mind depend upon these two elements. The organization of the mind may be defined as the group of laws which determine the modes of thought and of action, irrespective of the subject matter of mental activity. Subject to such laws are the manner of discrimination between perceptions, the manner in which perceptions associate themselves with previous perceptions, the manner in which a stimulus leads to action, and the emotions produced by stimuli. These laws determine to a great extent the manifestations of the mind. In these, we recognize hereditary causes. But on the other hand, the influence of individual experience can easily be shown to be very great. The bulk of the experience of man is gained from oft-repeated impressions. It is one of the fundamental laws of psychology that the repetition of mental processes increases the faculty with which these processes are performed and decreases the degree of consciousness that accompanies them. This law expresses the well-known phenomena of habit. There's an inverse proportion, he says. When a certain perception is frequently associated with another previous perception, the one will habitually call forth the other. When a certain stimulus frequently results in a certain action, it will tend to call forth habitually the same action. If a stimulus has often produced a certain emotion, it will tend to reproduce it every time. These belong to the group of environmental causes. The explanation of the activity of the mind of man, therefore, requires the discussion of two distinct problems. The first bears upon the question of unity, or diversity of organization of the mind, while the second bears upon the diversity produced by the variety of contents of the mind as found in various social and geographic environments. The task of the investigator consists largely in separating these two causes and in attributing to each its proper share in the development of the peculiarities of the mind. Now, of course, one can see it is a real problem in this genius. The problem is that in separating mind and environment for analytical purposes, one has to strategically keep aware of the fact that you have to bring those back together again. Your motive for analysis was to separate them, to look in them into their functions in a discriminative, separated way. But the strategic proviso was that, in actual fact, they work together. The first generation of students remembered this because the old man was there. And the first generation of students thought that this was just obvious, so they didn't stress it very much, so that the third generation that came along, two generations after them, forgot the strategic proviso entirely. And some were only concerned with the mind, and some were only concerned with the environment. In the meantime, in that split, some of the subject matter of the science of anthropology on their own learned the language and spoke up. And such a figure we're looking at as one of our ritual texts, Black Elk. When he was young, he was just a subject for anthropological study. And when he was old, he transcended the perspective of anthropology head and tail, to use an old fishing metaphor. We're using Black Elk's The Seven Rites of the Oglala Sioux, the Sacred Pipe. Let me give you a description. This book on the Sacred Pipe was written in the early 1950s, published by the University of Oklahoma Press, which has done about 200 books in a series on the civilization of the American Indian. In the preface, which was written about 20 years later, in 1971, the editor, the author-editor, Joe Brown, writes this, and this is his description of, and I will speak anthropologically, this is his description of his informant from an anthropological perspective. I went to find Black Elk in the fall of 1947 after I had followed his traces across many of the western states. Do you get a little associative twinge? The stage of finding the traces. It's like the ten bulls. He didn't know. He was like Carlos Castaneda going to see Don Juan. Just an old Indian, right? He's a graduate student. Well, he found him. And we'll see. He found someone who could stand up. Not just a passive subject matter, but turns out to be spiritual sage. What a shock. After I had followed his traces across many of the western states, we finally met in an old canvas wall tent on a Nebraska farm where his family and other members of their band were employed by harvesting potatoes. Real alert culture. Having sage like Black Elk near the end of his life picking potatoes on the farm in Nebraska shows the extent of unconsciousness. During that first encounter, we simply sat side by side on a sheepskin and silently smoked the redstone pipe, the calumet, the sacred pipe, which I had brought with me as an offering in the traditional manner. I highlight this for you. There are many gifts that one can bring, and the traditional gift is to bring tobacco. Brown brought the calumet, the sacred pipe, for reasons that he still doesn't know. when he thought in his mind about going to see Black Elk, he wasn't aware that Black Elk was already thinking about him. And when he thought, well, what gift shall I bring this man? The symbolic image of a sacred pipe came up in Brown's mind, and so he thinks he just brought it as a traditional gift. But what he was doing, he was bringing the central symbol of what Black Elk wanted to disclose to him. Did he put it in Joe Brown's mind? It resonated in Joe Brown's mind because Black Elk was making that resonation happen, which is the spiritual way of talking. We simply sat side by side on a sheepskin. Notice the ritual iconography that's just potent with symbolism. And silently smoked the redstone pipe, which I had brought with me as an offering in the traditional manner. Partly crippled, almost completely blind, he seemed a pitiful old man as he sat there hunched over, dressed in poor cast-off clothing. But the beauty of his face and the reverent quality of his movements as he smoked the pipe revealed that Neihardt, the first anthropologist who talked to Black Elk in the early 1930s, 20 years before, revealed that Neihardt had given us the essence of the man, and the subsequent years spent with Black Elk have confirmed this initial impression. Knowing that Black Elk usually had refused to talk with any other people, it was with relief and wonder that I heard his first words. He had anticipated my coming and wished for me to spend that winter with him, for he had much to tell of the sacred things before they should all pass away. That was in 1947. It's just an old man sitting in a canvas tent on a farm in Nebraska in fifth-hand clothing. But I have a photo of Black Elk, which was taken just 2 years before, in 1945. Mr. Hall gave it to me one time. We were talking about the spiritual integrity of American Indians that we knew. Mr. Hall became sensitized to the spiritual excellence of American Indians when an Indian named Hosteen Klaw came to visit him about the same time that Neihardt went to visit Black Elk. The events were synchronistic. Hosteen Klaw came to Los Angeles and stayed with Mr. Hall and left certain things with him, and Neihardt went to Black Elk. There's a complementation here. And Hosteen Klaw and Black Elk were the two greatest living sages of at that time in the United States. There was an American Indian sage in Canada named Tatanga Mane, Walking Buffalo, but he was in Canada. And Tatanga Mane and Hehapa Sapa, as Black Elk is called, and Hosteen Klaw were like a triangle. They were like a triumvirate of spiritual masters in the primordial American Indian tradition. And they brought out in a kind of a timely way the essential transformative wisdom, not just in man's mind, but in the land, in the environment. It's in both places at the same time. I'll go into Tathanga Mani, who was a like a grandfather to me at some other time. But let me show you the picture of black elk that Mr. Hall had made in 1945, when at the end of the Second World War, black elk stood up in Denver, Colorado, and showed that he wasn't just an old man. He was born in 1862. So how old would he be in 1945? 38 plus 45. He's pretty old. He's over 80. But this photograph shows black elk is holding up, as you can see, the one hand, which is not just a symbol for peace. That hand held up like that is like a symbolic pitch pipe, meaning teaching is coming. And in the other hand, he holds up the speaker's cadence maker, the right to speak. I don't know where my cadence maker is. I had it on my desk and it's gone, that wand that I had. The ancient way of telling the truth is that one speaks in a special cadence. For instance, it's a universal thing in human culture. I don't have my Japanese wand at hand. This is from West Africa. This is a storyteller's cane. This is a contemporary version of a traditional storyteller's cane from West Africa. Nigeria, Cameroons, that area. And the tapping out of the rhythm, the establishing of the cadence, is to, when one tells the stories, when one tells the mythology of the tribe, one is conveying the inescapably essential truth, trying to turn that language into a strong form. You're not just telling the stories, but you're imparting through language what is essential. It must be known. And it must be known in its ritual form. And the integrity of the ritual form is conveyed by the smoothly unrolling of the language in its ritual meter, so that at certain points when one interrupts that meter, the interruptions are loud silences, so that the emphases are highlighted by the regularity of the general repetitiveness of the language and the cadence. This is the way that traditional wisdom always has been passed on. I say always, and you can put a capital A on that, hundreds of thousands of years, as long as some hills have been in places. This is black elk in 1945 in the postures that the photograph signals. One is ready to speak. It took about 2 years from that for the right person to tune in to black elk's readiness to speak. And the sacred pipe is that speech that is delivered through the author Joe Brown to whoever can hear that, whoever has ears to hear, let him hear. And he gives the seven rites of the sacred pipe. And we talked last week about putting it into the sevenfold form. That's done as a courtesy to the listeners. If it's being given to an American Indian audience, one doesn't put it in the sevenfold structure at all. It's in a cyclic ritual continuity in terms of the four seasons. But the seven rites is put so that those who have a a kind of European or a kind of an Asian psychic disposition will be able to hear it and understand it. So Black Elk is speaking no longer just to the Indians, but he's speaking to the world. And the sacred pipe is that speech to the world. But before these seven rites are given, and the first of the rites is the keeping of the soul. And if you recall, if you were here, I asked you to read that, but also to read the initial story, the gift of the sacred pipe. Who gives the sacred pipe? Her mythic image is white buffalo cow woman. The sacred pipe is given by a woman to man. And you can say, in an associated way, this is like Sophia. This is like Athena. But then one has to curb that associativeness and then set that aside and see that this is not Sophia. This is not Athena. This is white buffalo cow woman. And then one has to hear how Black Elk speaks, how he delivers the origins of the pipe, because exactly in the right ritual way of telling the origins of the pipe is one set in the right way to hear the rituals in their interlinkedness. The fact that they're given as seven interlinked rituals is just a cultural bias which Black Elk is recognizing in his audience. For an Indian audience, it would be in a different form, be in the four seasons. What's important, though, is the strategic understanding of the interlinkedness that all of the rites, R-I-T-E-S, all of the rites form a ritual cycle. And that the ritual cycle is the essence, the spiritual essence of nature, which is in our heredity, which is in our minds. When we know the ritual interlinkedness so that the cycle is complete, we know the essence of our heredity, the essence of our minds, and that is also the essential sap of nature. It's what makes nature go. What makes nature go makes us real. And what makes us real makes nature go. That quality, the Lakota word for that was wakan. Wakan means holy. Means what we would mean by holy. Like in the sense of the holy. But Wakan always has with it, in a subconscious way, the sense of someone. What is holy is always someone who is holy. Wakan Tonka, the Great Spirit. The Holy Spirit. So that the essential flow that's in nature and in us is the same Great Spirit, is the Great Spirit in the same way. Not to know that, the wisdom which saves us kills. Not to know that. And it's like this, if I can use this kind of metaphor, and then we'll come back next week. It's like a great bolt of energy is coming, and if you receive it in a closed way, it will hit you. If you receive it in an open way, it revivifies you and links you with all life. So that the more one tries to engender a sense of consciousness, the more one has to understand ethically to remember to keep it open, to keep the spirit trail in the composition. Because the more one raises consciousness, the more, if you're closed, you will be hit. And long before you're hit, the intuition, your inner intuition, tells you to cringe and duck and watch out, because it's nothing to play with. So the more conscious people come and not become open, the more neurotic they become over unseen, so-called unconscious aspects, and the more they try to guard against them ever coming out, ever touching them. I'm going to take enough pills, man, that nothing's ever going to touch me. Please bring your masks. I want to stop with showing Jerry's mask, just to show it. He didn't bring his journal, so he doesn't have the right to talk about it. But he did bring his mask, so he has the right to show it. I'm not singling out Jerry without his permission. Jerry is one of the few people that comes both Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, so he's getting the whole picture. He's getting the whole scheme. Come on up here, Jerry, and just show for a minute.
I did a strawberry, and I'm growing them, and I just couldn't really get into it. You know, after I got done, for me, my emotions are very important. And when I one of my emotions that I have the most problem with is my anger. So I had fun depicting my anger. And after I got this one done, then I wanted to go back and redo the strawberry, which I didn't do.
Let's hold them up together. The strawberry has a velvety texture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this fabric
flocked.
Is
locked paper.
But it was fun. You know.
More next week. Bring your masks. Thank you, Jerry.
Yeah.